Hey everyone, welcome to my latest and newest episode of Ag Uncensored with me, your host, Nathan Folliti. And today I have another guest that has been around the ag space for quite a long time and doing some interesting stuff. And actually, I think me and Randy, we haven't talked much personally. But we've ran across, I think, we've been at the same shows multiple times. But anyways, I got Randy Barker here of CEO of Intent. And they do quite a bit of things in the ag tech space. And he's been involved in some other fun startups and then corporate side in the past. So, but I don't need to talk about that. Randy, tell people about yourself and what else is in your world.
Yeah. Well, you got the. I was glad you didn't say how many years I've been in ag, but several, right? So it's a while, but they've been helpful. So with Intent, been here 8 years. We'll be 8 years September, working as CEO and building business with our team and expanding. Prior to that, we spent a short time at a startup. So that was like a 18-month gig and pretty formative. It was one of those.
That was an interesting one. We were
It
talking
was
a little
quick.
bit.
It was
We'll
like,
get to that later.
yeah, like I said, well, what'd you, it goes into the bucket of did you fail or learn something? So I learned something. And then prior to that, decade with Monsanto working globally, across the portfolio and lots of interesting things with customer experience and product segments, seed treatments, weed control, and ag retail before I joined Monsanto in Canada. So Western Canada is my origination, Alberta specifically, and started as an agronomist in the field, and then thought it'd be nice to get a management job. And there's days that I'm like, I don't know about that. I don't know if that was the best idea. We went through like two mergers in 3.5 years, and I said I just got to get something more simple and join Monsanto. So wrong. That was like, well, good guess, but it was a great. Well, I learned something. So they were all fantastic opportunities, and yeah, Intent. We're doing lots of interesting things, as you said.
Yeah, so we were talking a little bit before, and there's plenty to talk about in the broad scape of ag tech and ag. And I think I could just talk about probably Western Canada agriculture and the birth of precision ag practices there, as I kind of grew up through a lot of the things that happened there, just because of being in North Dakota, so close to it, and with the imagery side that I grew up around, it was just kind of a more of a natural fit. So a lot has changed there, but some things haven't. But anyways,
Good stuff still there.
yeah. So explain a little bit, because I think this will be a good kind of segue into just everything else. Explain more what Intent does, or what it started as, what it's doing now, where is it going, what's special about it, why is it important in
Yeah.
ag?
Well, I think what's interesting, someone said, good news is vision hasn't changed. Really just the implementation. And when we started Intent, Kevin and myself, we said, man, with all this precision ag data, it was growing, and we really could start to, I'm like, we can characterize products specifically so we can get to recommendations, because farmers, and still today, they really just want to know, what it is. Will it work on that field? How do I use it? And what's the over under on profitability? And yeah, a whole bunch of other stuff to reach that. But they're like, could you get there? And we're like, yeah, this is doable, which it is. So today we run we have our trial software Envision, and we have lots of customers using it either as a SaaS or managed services, and that's where all the data comes from. So collecting all the data, we'll go into some of the machinations involved with that and what's worked well and not. But it was always, you know, if we just had yield data, then you're like, well, we definitely need imagery, earth observations, and we need maybe a drone, maybe this water sensor. And you're like, soils data. And you're, oh, wow. It's like 9 variables or always more than 5, and more the merrier explains product performance. So that's what we're still core in that. That's where we started. And, you know, when we began, we'll just, you know, maybe climate or someone will let us use their system, or, you know, those farm logs then or something. You're like, surely to goodness, we could just run trials through a different system. And that answer was wrong.
Yeah.
No, they're all for farmers. They were all for farmers, nothing serving B2B in that space. And you're like,
well, the only thing you maybe could have used is, and this would have just not worked anyways, is kind of a more broad-based GIS system like QGIS or Esri. Mm-hmm. But
yep,
there's limits to that, you know, especially on the ag side. And I think, and there's been some others, you know, that are doing some similar stuff, that building, you know, some of these comparative model product softwares. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you want to exactly call it, but if you got a name for it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, it's exactly it. It's like, you go back through the software, and that's what we built today, is this multi-user easy engagement through Envision. But yeah, we just wanted to run a side-by-side or multiple strips so that we could understand not only the product, but instead of like small plot trials, instead of eliminating the noise is good, right? Because the highest yielding area and the lowest yielding area are relevant, definitely in characterizing product, right? You're looking at high yield scenarios and low yield. So it's like, they're all good data elements, but you know, that's what we wanted to achieve. But yeah, you're right. It's like, I was kind of smiling. You're like, oh, you could QGIS and Esri or SMS. And you're like, mm-hmm, yep, done it, used it. Yep, Python, R, Shiny. You know, it was like this Frankenstein of stuff that was used. And you know, that's where a few years in, we just said that's it, man. We got to bite the bullet. And we called it a portal. And it was just like, farmers are saying, I need a place to upload this stuff. And it went from upload stuff to, like I said, multi-user hierarchy, in-app, GIS, mobile. And
all the fun stuff that is a lot harder to develop than I'd say most anybody in ag actually comprehends.
That was like the last 5 years was the version one, which was really good, but it, you know, step change. Then we realized volume and back-end architecture was a big deal too, which made us go into that.
It's always, you know, I've seen countless, everyone calls them MVPs, you know, get your minimal viable product out, and it's always a good starting point. And right when you get that out, then you just start getting all these questions from people. It's like, well, can you add this now? Can you add this? And you're like, guys, that took like a year and a lot of money just to get that done, and we're just starting to service and support it. Like, can you please stop so we can just do some work and then get to see what actually makes sense? Because I mean, heck, especially in kind of the world you're working on, because people want those proof of results. You know, that's been one of the biggest challenges in all the precision ag and ag tech space since its inception is, and it's why there's still giant problems with it, because how do you prove that some of these things work? Like, you can grab all this data, then it's like, all right, well, now I need to interpret it right. Well, that's hard. And then if I do interpret it right and I match it with other data, I have to interpret that right and then put them together in a way where I can actually understand what the hell to do.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, this field is different than that field. Oh, wait, there's like 10 zones in this field that are all different. How is that going to react to this product in this way?
Right.
Oh, and then at this population or this amount of nitrogen versus that. And you start like opening this web of like, it's just there. It's almost impossible to figure out 100%, but
Absolutely.
And that's what scares people away. Like, have you found that at least just biting kind of that bullet and going through it just to try to do something? Because, I mean, these tools, like you said, you had to build one because something didn't really exist to kind of handle it that way. Are people opening their eyes and kind of self-educating on how this stuff works? Or
Well, that's where, like I said, the Envision, the trial data collector, you're right on, is, you know, it collects a ton of data, and you do have to get to the answer. And that's what it's good at is, you know, I have six reps. But when you start to parcel it out, you go, man, that's a lot of environments. There's variability. Okay, this field's very different than that field. And you got to do enough of that to find meaning, right? One location, you know, even with a whole bunch of data points within it, you're going to learn something. But I wouldn't conclude a product decision either as an individual farmer or as a company. Like, that's not going to get her done. So you have to start building breadth and think about data as, you know, that data collection is a process, and that's where we solved. And then on the other hand is you go, well, now I have a year, 2 years, many sites. You still have a lot of data. You derive some insights in Envision, and that's where we built the ANOVA, where we're starting to project that out. And you go, well, how do you do that? Well, you take all those millions of points of data and you look for similarity, and you start to project and synthesize data. And you go, well, I don't know perfectly, but I can look at field, you know, the 100 that were in the trial and, you know, the millions that were not, and at least try to estimate and ascribe a performance given similar conditions. Now, weather changes, but that's where that part of the business is really new to us. What was the original part of the original vision? It's like, how do you get there? And that's been really, really pretty cool. And to your point is like, you'll never be 100% right. You know, we're trying to move off being 100% wrong.
Well,
and you're like, well, and it's like, yeah, well, 70% would be better than guess.
Although what's call it the culture of agriculture is, you know, it's as we've been peeling open these layers, these onion layers of ag, like, oh, this is how that works. Oh, this is how that works. It almost, I mean, there's some that just, they're not going to do it because they're just scared of just stepping in the door. And then there's others that are just like, until they can, they just like need to see it work a little bit, and then they can go in further. It's like that, the wave pool at a swimming place. And it's like, oh, it's really, really shallow. I mean, it's just nothing. And then they just kind of walk in, and then you have these crazy, crazy farmers that like, this is my mindset, because I'll dive back to this. It's a great analogy.
Good analogy.
On our my senior trip in high school, we went to the world's largest mall in Edmonton, which I'm guessing you're well aware of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know of the big wave pool there, and that you can bungee off the top.
I didn't know that.
Oh, well, yes, you can.
I've been in ag too long. I missed that.
maybe it came after you left there or whatever. Probably. So while most of the people were sitting in the wave pool, me and my friend, you know, we're going to go bungee jump into the wave pool. So
fun.
So, but that's kind of how it is. Like, most of our class was just like, nope, we're just going to sit at the edge. Some kind of went in, maybe wanted to use a board to go on the waves and get a little more in there. And then me and my idiot friend are like, we're just going to jump kind of to our potential death here. Hopefully everything works out and we'll be fine. But we're two people of 25 in our class. Yep. But that's how it kind of is with all this data and stuff. It's like, it takes so much to get people going in it. And there was all these expectations of, oh, here's even from the imagery side, oh, here's an image, here's this, you've got it figured out. Sure. On some things you can kind of sort of do little things like that.
Some things.
Simple black and white things, fungicide off, fungicide on in an area, you know. Yep. But once you start getting into seed varieties, different fertilizer rates, different types, biologicals, as are crazy these days.
Yeah.
It can become so overwhelming and complex. And here's the question I'm getting to too is, does by doing these things and finding out what these products can do, changing the rates, finding, you know, doing these trials and actually getting to that higher end of figuring it out, but then we're changing things. So then what we're sensing back in the field from yield, from satellites, from soils, we're actually kind of changing what we're observing, and then that's skewing older data.
Absolutely. So
how are you dealing with that? Or what's your, like, how does that, what's that thought process around
it? Because there's a lot in there. So the West Edmonton Mall reference is good. and I was thinking about the wave pool, and the way I looked at it is that, you know, there's that part on the, in the shallow, you could be on, you know, big wave masters at Kona or something. And you're like, no deal, no problem. I'm on the beach. Waves, I can see them. But if I'm in this much water, they don't harm. And then if you're actually way out, it's just swells and you're having fun. It's right in the middle that people get wiped out. And I think it's the same here, you know, with data. And it's like, and maybe we expect, you know, a lot from it. So overpromising kind of skips the reality of the journey. So you go, well, I'm either a believer or non-believer. And you go, well, time out. I mean, that's a pretty black and white view. I either buy into, you know, I think of older technologies that become relevant. GPS, you know, it didn't get to where it is in your phone today in a year. It sucked. Same with processing. So I think everything you have to take with a grain of salt. And I think that's one of our challenges in the industry is these short-term, what I would say we love to get over myopic, right? Well, I have a sensor. And if I knew this, it's over. Mm-hmm. And I think we convinced ourselves, you know, I like all the sensors and I can usually, and that goes from drones to satellite to moisture, but it doesn't like overthrow agronomy, right? In general, or general biology, environmental science. You're like, you can't just skip that and go, I've found the key to the agronomy panacea. So I'm with you. It's like, it's not an either or. And, you know, there's a lot been, the other part I was thinking about when you said that was, you know, there's a lot of tradition into how we we don't like precision ag, big data, the, you know, we'll get to ML, we're doing ML, good AI, you know, it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But at the other end of the spectrum, where you were talking about 100%, I got one of the hardest things we've experienced, and it's waning because the tides have turned, is, you know, small plot research. When there's a complete randomized block, is it 6 replications? And, you know, it's 95% confident. And I'm in my brain going, I agree that amongst other candidates at that site during that year, I trust your stats. I am a stats guy. And I believe you're 90% CI on that site or group of 10 sites or 25. What I'm not buying is I have no clue about the CLU on the farm outside of Fargo on the North 40, and particularly, you know, that field. Yep. How does that reliability translate to that? Oh, well, it should work. And you're like, my God, this is
all the marketing and plot trials from universities to the corporates. And you're like, the biggest thing that always pisses me off is, I mean, for one, you'll drive by like a soybean plot and you see the different heights and bushiness. And it's like, oh, and someone takes a picture and like this, I'll call it Asgrow because why not?
Yeah.
It's whatever, you know, 0032, whatever is, it's bigger and thicker and you should buy this. I'm like, well, soybeans, they can be 5 feet high and yield crap, or they can be 2 feet high and be amazing. It's just the proof is weird in that set. And then, and on top of that, like, oh, some of them, it's like, well, you gain, if you switch to this brand, you're guaranteed, or this type of variety, you know, whatever, you'll get guaranteed 2 more bushels an acre. Be like, and I'm just like, bullshit. Well, maybe. Sure.
Seems unlikely, actually, if you tackle that statistically, that you would actually get those additional 2 bushels. Mathematically, you go, no, you'll end up on the distribution somewhere. I don't know if it's -2, 0, +8, you know. Yeah. You have to start somewhere. So I'm not, you know, crapping all over my entire science agronomy career. But you go, I'm just not satisfied that that's sufficient.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get back to your bungee jump. You're like, well, are you going to have fun? Or are you just going to go, it's not existing. So I've never bungee jumped before. So therefore, no one bungee jumps. You're like, well, it wouldn't be here if no one was going to do it. So I think, you know, I look backwards and you go, right, it's happening. It's hard. It's glacial. There's a lot of bodies and failures on the road, but yeah, it's probably that more reality of farmer view, right? It's like, it's constant failure. You just hope not to go broke.
Well, and I, you know, to the point, even on the AI and ML, I mean, clearly it's, you know, giant buzzword going on everywhere in the world. And then ag is clearly picking up on it. And I'm for it in the right context, but I think what people need to remember, farmers need to think about this too. And then the ag businesses around it, or maybe the startups using it a few colleagues have said, it's more augmented intelligence. It's just kind of doing what more humans can do in a more of a collective state. But if we don't train these processes right, and you don't do it properly, so like even the test plot results, you know, to your point, that might not actually translate well into an AI ML product in normal field.
Right.
And it's like, we have to take a step back and recognize that, okay, if you're using it for other plot work, yeah, probably it'll work if you can understand that. If you're doing it, you know, side-by-side trials, you know, 20 acres here, 20 acres there in a field, okay, that's different. And we haven't done collectively enough testing like that, I think, on a lot of these products. But that's kind of where groups like yourself, you're saying, we need to do things like this because the old way is imperfect.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so much. I mean, like any buzzword, it usually, anything that's exciting that everyone gets spun up about usually holds merit, but is so poorly defined that, you know, we flounder around. Some people use it to garner resources or attention. And then you go to the reality. I would say it's up there with like sustainability or, you know, digital. You're like, cool. It does exist. It is real. I'm in, but the things that you also know is we're augmenting, right? And I think about what we could do is, you know, back to the farm level, field level as an agronomist, what it's going to help is, you know, capacity for things I know are impossible to do. Literally as an agronomist in that function, I can't look at more than one field at a time. I can't process the, you know, whether it's a farmer or an agronomist as an individual, I'm thinking is processing hundreds of variables simultaneous with what you see, know, and all that stuff. That's what makes us smart. Mm-hmm. Now I can literally be analyzing a full field with all the stuff I hadn't seen in that field and history. And there's like, I couldn't even manage one field at a level that ML and AI will get us to. The other side of the coin is, you know, our habit is bigger than available claims. And I when we were World Agritech, I was like, you can't be in some instances in ag, you can be mostly right and be okay, right? You pick a soybean variety, you'll be fine, right? Because most of the genetics are pretty good. You pick a good one for that field, yeah, you'll be better than your average. If you did a really good job, you might be better than your history, right? Mm-hmm. That's all good. But if you mess up an application or AI is running your monitor and didn't, oh, sorry, I got the wrong herbicide. Oh, my, yeah. There goes that crop. Like there's some little misses in a language model or, you know, writing some text or making a goofy picture.
Whatever.
Not a lot of harm.
Yeah.
Wrong product on a crop. Catastrophic.
Well, and I think that's, you know, where some of the, there's some hesitancy around even some of the see and spray stuff or, yeah, you know, things of that nature, you know, changing things on the go. And I, yeah, buzz, it sounds great. You know, let's show this at, you know, CES and everybody's like, oh my God, we didn't know, you know, ag did futuristic things like Apple and Google and whatever. And it's like, I'm sitting there and it's like, yeah, that's cool to show, but getting farmers to actually do it, yeah, is really hard because of that fear you just said. It's like, okay, this camera is supposed to take this video live feed or whatever, and then recognize that this is a plant that needs to be killed and sprayed. Okay. Well, can it actually see everything?
Yeah.
And if it doesn't get the right plant, well, I mean, you look at, I mean, some weeds, they create, you know, thousands and thousands of seeds. So yeah, if you miss one.
Water hemp.
Yeah.
You missed
one little instance, and then it's like, boom.
Yeah.
It can just ruin a patch. And I mean, and how many times could that happen in a field? You know, is it a 0.1% error rate?
Right.
Five. And so for guys, like when I've been talking to them, for one, some are wanting to charge like an acre charge, which I think is kind of crazy and dangerous, but whatever. That's a different story. They're just like, I can't sleep at night unless I spray everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I just can't, because it was like, it's worked. It kills it. I don't care if the sensors are perfect. That thing's also complicated. Comes with wires, more computers, more service support. And it loses half of its value overnight after I buy it.
Yeah.
It's so hard. Like you can buy a cheap sprayer for pretty cheap.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, provided residual, you know, driven chemistries, which, you know, in my experience on weed control was always, you know, when certain herbicides fail to work, you know, multiple modes of action and residuals is the solution agronomically, right? Yeah. And I think of, you know, see and spray and tweaked another thought. So I'm going to come back to the residuals, but you tweak this thought about, you know, oh, it's novel. That's the power of a brand. And at CES show, and I'm like, wasn't like Green Seeker like ages ago, yeah, and it was invented in Australia. And they're like, well, we could use way less water and only spray our Roundup and burn down on select weeds. But wasn't that popular because there were some edge processing things. And back to your original point is, well, how much do I have to upgrade? And I can drive, you know, faster because the processing doesn't slow me down. And Roundup wasn't that expensive, especially as generics came into the market. So there's this economic, you know, reality that we're trying to tap into some value predictor. But, you know, I think those are challenges with almost any adoption is tradition, and there's an efficiency that's been achieved economically in a marketplace that isn't easy to just, that's why I hate we're going to disrupt it. And you're like, oh, good luck with that. Yeah, yeah. You're like, these are like a whole bunch of individual agents, right? Each farm is many, many little businesses. And you're going, oh, disrupt away. I mean, it better be great. And we've seen them like precision planting, high-speed planting, Roundup Ready. There's been some things that are, yep, you get it right. But
yeah,
that's not every year.
No, the 100 people that were going to disrupt everything, they were just disrupting my attitude, honestly. That's about all they were disrupting.
That's why I was excited to meet and have a conversation. I'm like, man, this Nathan's like very skeptical and cynical, which is a good counterpart, because I'm completely optimistic but practical too, because I'm like, oh yeah, we have the wounds. So probably a good yin and yang here that's like in the middle. It's like, no, it's doable, but don't get too jacked up on promises.
Well, and it's, you know, there's another coin I was looking at. I go on some of the ag forums once in a while, and just because I just want to hear farmers kind of bitch about stuff, because it's, and then read it. And I have just a passion for farming anyways. And as I spoke before, all I really want to do is farm anyways. So maybe I can get this popular enough and someone wants to buy it for a lot and I can just go farm. But there was and you'll understand this great, because, you know, especially in Canada, and it was a lot of more Canadian farmers complaining. It was like, do I upgrade from my hoe drill that just works and it doesn't take a lot of maintenance, puts seed in the ground, most of the time works fine, or do I upgrade to this new disc drill that literally costs $1 million? There's hoses everywhere.
Yeah.
There's bearings everywhere. There's all this stuff. Yes. Does it do a better job? Kind of. And there's this natural crazy debate, and it's an equipment thing, but it'll never stop. There's always this breaking point in ag between how far you can go between until it becomes almost, you have to be so big or of a certain size or in a certain part of, does that work everywhere? Unless they have a smaller one, but the big ones that they, you know, they came out, it's like,
right,
well, no, it just doesn't. But then that is like pushed out so much. And I think on the ag tech side, that's where we get into trouble, because we'll showcase something great and big. Mm-hmm. And yes, it can work. It's a novel approach. It can make people money on all sides, but it works for 1,000 people.
Yep.
That's it.
Like, yeah.
We're to that point. We're getting to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. With that type of scenario, I mean, that's, you know, like a lifetime of when you see the same repeating theme. And I reminded when I was, you know, smallholder farms in India, and you see someone planting with a stick and you're like, man, imagine if you had a tractor. And it's like, well, what would everyone do?
Yeah.
Like we still get everything planted. It's, you know, it's handmade. Scale of farms isn't the issue unless you group them up and you're like, well, now you're messing with something different. And then to your other extreme on ag tech, you know, it's no doubt better, but the number of farms that can use that, I mean, this is where we see a lot, I believe a lot of companies mess up, is total addressable market, particularly people who aren't in the ag side. And you go, well, how many farmers are there? Oh, there's a million farmers. You go, how many are relevant? 80, and it's declining. Within that, what really matters? Oh, there's 10,000. Yeah. You go, woo, okay.
Everyone's going after the same 10,000 people in entire
industry. How many? Then those are like top of the top. And you go, how many of those actually need a new combine that have that scale in these crop profiles? Okay. And then how many will buy it? Now you're like down to 180, which is maybe what defines the price strategy. I don't know.
I suppose. I mean, you can kind of almost see it on, you know, with a lot of prices, you know, I mean, just anything you think, look at luxury brands of the most expensive sports cars in the world. They're like, we're making 100, and they were sold 5 years ago.
Right.
Because we literally reached out to the 100 richest people in the world that love sports cars.
Yeah.
You know, so call it a lot of people in the Middle East, because that's they'll buy them up and whatever. And we just made it for them. But we just, it's like we're getting to that in ag to an extent. Right. Is it good? Is it bad? I don't know. There's good and bad to it. Because, you know, with technology, there's other good things that can, you know, we talk about sustainability stuff and things. If you use more tech, you can track these things, you can manage it more properly. And, But then what happens is, and when I think of like the farm bill and things like that, and some of the governance of these things and the regulations, when certain types of farms in certain areas, even if they are decent size, but they're just choosing to use older efficient equipment because they want to be savvy and money, and maybe they've added some tech to it, are they going to just get pushed out because it won't follow the technology plan of just up and up and up and up and better and better and better?
Like, yeah.
Are we going to catch ourselves in a weird spot? I hope not. I hope not.
Could be. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the risk part of the farming. They go, well, that's one of the fundamental parts of, you know, how big is your market? And you go, well, if you're John Deere, you can be kind of right and kind of wrong. Like if you're an incumbent market leader, you have some wiggle room. If you're a startup with a biological, I don't know how many luxury good farmer biological products are going to be bought. Like you're like, it doesn't even, when you say it out loud, it sounds silly or downright stupid. So you go, you got to think about market fit. And what you're talking about is customization and being much more specific in the benefit, right? So if I'm engineering my next combine, and I'm a big company, that's one thing. But you know, if you're small, you better get that market targeting and sizing right. It's like not everyone gets 90 million acres of corn in the US, 95. And that's where I see a lot of waste. But then on the farm side, you know, I think they're, I'm not pessimistic. I'm practical. And a lot of the farms have foundational technologies and they're already ahead of what technologies will be required to answer the unknown question that people are asking in this area of sustainability. I mean, there's some good companies doing some cool stuff, getting after quantification of CI and
and there's a lot of farmers that have been just doing it anyways. It's just
they're not
used to actually reporting it and maybe making money off it. They're like, oh, I've been doing this for 20 damn years.
That's like you should do min or zero till. And the only time it really offends them is like, oh yeah, then you don't qualify. And you're like, oh really? I mean, that is offensive. Like the person that's done the most that's something if anyone ever asks my opinion, if it's a customer, I'm like, don't do those programs. It's like charging for baggage on an airplane. I'm like, come on, man. You're just irritating us.
Well, that reminds me, my wife, she had to go to Denver this week and there's a direct flight from Frontier. And it's like, oh, super cheap ticket, $50. And it's like baggage fee, $100 each way. And oh, you want a pop? $5. It's just charge me $300. Like don't want to deal with it.
Well, it's like one of those simple, and farming and agriculture is like the least place you can afford those things, at least in flight and that competitive set. There's churn and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's like farming, you kind of pull that stuff. They remember and you're out. And if you're a startup, getting on one farm is plenty hard enough. You can't afford any churn, right? So you need to master the system before you get your first customer. Unlike cable, cable, the cord cutters, they're all dying too, right? Because they were so stubborn in the business model, and that they're like, hey, come back, you can stream, and you're like, no.
And then they just copied the business model of cable and like, well, now we're going to charge you $100 a month for your service.
Exactly. So now they charge you for wireless or internet, depending on the local area. So find new ways to screw you. But.
And so speaking of we were talking about, you know, kind of some of those issues of startup. So before Intent, you were with a little fun company, Machinery Link, right?
I was. Machinery Link. It was good.
Yeah, like, I mean, it was honestly, and I there was others that were kind of trying to do some things like this. And I think there's a broader story here, just to kind of talk through it, of the trials and tribulations of technology and ag. It's like, oh, when combines, you know, they're as they, it's just like custom combine. You're following that model more or less. Right. Like, oh, you start in Texas early. We're done in Texas. You go to Kansas or Oklahoma. And you go to Kansas. And you go to Nebraska. You go to South Dakota. You go North Dakota. Then you go up into Canada and you're done. Like, oh, that just needs one combine and no one needs to store it. And the business model is like, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, and that one was, you know, it was pretty interesting because it was split into two parts. Machinery Link, which followed that model, which is, you know, interesting as businesses, you go, yeah, go to the opportunity, right? It's on the board and you go, yeah, you don't need, you know, fleet of 400 combines doing something a fleet of 100 could do, right? And yeah. Because it's contract, it was a good spot in good theory. You know, so as that side tried to expand the footprint, what you started finding out is that farmers like the control of machine ownership to, I don't like sharing, right? They would add portions of their field custom harvested because that was their surge capacity for, you know, that was the outsource that they got extra stuff done. Some relied on 100%, but that was good. And then the parlay into ag data and analytics is where, you know, good idea before it's time. And really, you know, it's a, as you know, tough space to penetrate, whether it's ag retail or farm level. I think that was just a massive underestimation of, you know, this is slow, you know, little wins are good wins. And, you know, so those two sides of the business, the data side really just hit the wall real quick.
Well, and I wonder if, you know, and that was, like I said, it's a different time. And with some of the equipment, the prices is getting, maybe that model can be explored again, especially if people want to kind of keep up with the times. It maybe can make sense to an extent. Yep. But to that other point, that's kind of been, and I think this goes into the data side too. There's just this natural want to own and hold your own thing in farming.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's why GPS and monitors, I think, have been super successful and they rose up great. It's like, for one, I can hit a button and drive straight and I don't have to drive.
Yeah.
Two, I can physically own it and I can physically sell it for a good price still.
It's an asset.
It's an asset. And that's how people think of machinery and ag. They always have, always will. And yes, there is a percentage that are like, we don't care. Like Western Kansas, a lot of people do custom harvesting there. Not a lot of people own their combines out there. So it's like their mantra is great. And even in Texas and Oklahoma, North Dakota and Canada, it's like you get other custom harvesters to fill gaps and get time constraints. It's all about time.
It's about times because your snow is going to happen.
Yeah, so you're going to own a base fleet no matter what because of timing. You cannot wait for someone being trailered up or anything. It's like, hey, get here when you get here to fill a gap so I don't have to deal with it.
It's today. We have 3 days before it snows in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. So let's go.
Yeah. So, you know, in the data side, and that's part of it too. It's like, well, I just want to hold it. It's mine. I'll use it for my own purposes in, and I'm sure you deal with this on the intent side. It's like, okay, well, yes, here's this data, but you know, just make sure you don't share that with XY other, you know, company you're working with. And I mean, I'm sure you respect that, but is like, are we just stuck in that culture?
Are like that? That's what makes adoption of anything in ag difficult, because there's an existing perceived, either it's a habit or an efficiency. It's kind of the way I look at the two things and go, okay, well, these are habits. And the thing that I believe is, and it came from traveling around country to country, visiting different farms, big farms, little farms, country-sized farms, you know, million-acre farms. And you're going, that's not a farm. That's, however, you know, that they always had this premium on, they do things the way they do for a reason.
Yeah.
it's not, I haven't met a dumb farm operation. I've met with all of them that want to improve, but there's everything that happens in those operations has a reason, from how they store grain, move grain, don't store grain, ship logistics from Brazil to South Africa to Ukraine to North Dakota. It's different because it is, and they have these reasons. So those are, you got to make something change. And what we've found on the data side working with farmers is like, we've had none of that friction. Like people said, oh, you're going to be in this space. And it's like every farmer would say, hey, will you be willing to do this trial, evaluate this product? They go, well, what are we doing here? Well, let me explain what the product's expected to do. We don't know if it's going to work or not, but this is the game plan. Oh, okay, I'm in. And what are you going to do with the data? Well, we're going to take it in. We're going to process. We'll report the product report back in aggregate to the company, and we'll give you your field report with the answer about that to you. That's the deal. In fact, often we'll compensate a farmer just to execute that data scene, right? There's a lot of risk work and other aspects to that. And it worked. I can say we've never really had any issue around data or privacy with farmers because we've always had a purpose. We give them something back and we do keep it private. And so well, there's almost like a no deal. So Every time people bring that up, I'm like, I don't know where that's coming from, but what they say is don't do anything that's using my data to harm me. I go, well, cool.
Yeah. It's like, have we just, and then I think a lot of are trying to do that kind of similar model. It's like, hey, I'm just trying to help you. Here's the rules. Here's how it works. You get A, this gets B, that gets C, and everyone's happy. And I mean, that's just how it should be.
Right.
But yet and we all know that some have not taken that play at times.
Right.
And some of those groups have, and this is not blaming where you used to work either. That's a different story, but just others in the space. And then it's created like this sour taste. It's like, it's good that you said it that way. It's like, we're trying to gain back this potential confidence around what data can do in ag versus what's been kind of showcased that it maybe can do. We need to prove that, okay, we need to prove that something works or doesn't work in that situation to build step one in that confidence. No different than my toddler right now. He's on one of those little Strider bikes. And the first day he got to him, he's like, I don't know. I'll use the trike because there's three wheels, a little more stable. And then the next day, and I was like, you know, here, look at your sisters. They're on their bikes. You got to go on your bike. He's like, okay. And he just starts going around, gets used to it. Just like these little, you know, paths to success. It doesn't have to be perfect. You fall a couple times. And then all of a sudden now he's like, he'll be on a normal bike without training wheels in like 6 months. Cause he'll go down a hill with his arms out full speed, like a little evil. So I got another problem on my hands.
That's the reckless bungee jumping.
Yeah, it's in the blood. Yeah,
that's not
great. Creating crazy companies and doing podcasts and all that stuff.
Trust and confidence goes to bad decision making, which is like iterated on my picture behind me. It's like yep, that's bad decision making, but I've got it out of my system. And you go, let's data. I think it's just that customer relationship. Or thinking it through, and you see so many companies burn up, and you know before they even start, it's like, oh, you're out. You just blew yourself up, and you know it was the death knell. It's like, give me all your data to help me start my business. You're like, why would I do that? And then they go, no, it'll be good for you. And then the ones that are foiled, they're going, this was not at all good for me.
Yeah,
and I didn't get money. I didn't learn anything. And I feel like you robbed my house.
Well, so, maybe that's the point that you said, I didn't learn anything from it.
Yeah.
Because so many softwares and processes, and it's not all. I mean, there's plenty of great, good ones out there and people that have done good at this, but if you can't learn from that experience and you're just like, oh, it's just here for, to be here. It's just here to exist. It's like, that's where we've almost been kind of stuck. I don't think we started that way.
No.
When I go back to the, you know, 90s and 2000s, you know, just growing up in this, the path was of, hey, let's try this, learn it, and then expand. And it was right. going. And it's like when all the money came in, you know, in the last 10 years, it was like, we'll skip learning. We just want, right. we just want execution of more fun money.
Option. And fundraising. Yeah. Yeah.
We just want users. Yeah. And it was, and it's created so much, so many problems. And now we just have to like dig out of the rubble of sorts. And, you know, yeah. the people that are here that are trying, you know, things like you said, and like, hey, I'm just going to show you this. I'm going to teach you this. You're going to learn from it and see that it has value. Like, of and then course, they, that's they what teach you
us, right? And they teach us. I mean,
yeah. And then you learn from your client.
Like, how'd you build this? Well, we worked with farmers and the client, and we, you know, started to understand the types of questions that we'd help companies and farmers understand the difference between farming systems and product. Same time, and you're like, wow. And you go, can you be? It sounds very altruistic. It's like, no, it's not a not-for-profit, but hopefully the farmer gets something that helps drive their profitability. We get to stay in business and keep building better stuff based on their feedback. And the customer is getting better innovation. You know, it can actually all work, but yeah. you know, that other part that you, it's, I think there's just this, the money was just like, given a 16-year-old boy a $2 million inheritance, you're like, this is not a good idea, right? And that's kind
of
how
it works. The values of, I mean, some of the companies that did get sold, and everyone knows who they are, for crazy evaluations. And sure, some that have gotten sold, it's been valued correct. Some, it's just crazy. And then you think of, okay, your path, doing this 8 years, finding this out, you're learning from your clients, building these things. Like, if someone just handed me, I'll just say me as an example, $100 million and say, build what Randy's built, I would tell them, like, I can't.
I can't do it.
It's like, I can't.
Yeah.
Because I don't have 8 years of all these unique stories and things. But, and that's hard for business to translate that into value, and that value in people's heads. And that's one thing that I'll say, just from building software, and even like from what my family's company built, it's been like, there's actually 30 years worth of things in this.
Yeah.
But can I showcase that? It's very intangible. It's very hard to show that asset. And that's maybe one of the problems we have in ag and tech and agronomy. The agronomy side of it directly is there's all these intangible assets in technology and ag that it's so hard, and it makes it hard for farmers to understand the value of it just themselves, or the value of that software or that product or that solution or that acre charge. They just the expense or loss. It's like, everyone's having that challenge, whether it was done poorly or correctly.
That's a deep insight, because I think from a farmer's standpoint, they're going, what they achieved this year is not just this year's operation, right? It's like generational, individual. There's a ton piled into that, right? In terms of logic. And it's like, they have great yields this year. It wasn't because of the change they made this year only, right?
Yeah.
It's a whole bunch of stuff. And I think that works for businesses as well. And I can't, and it works on the science side, right? So if I think about any of the successes that we have seen sort of start to cut through, you're like, yeah, it's like a 10 plus year effort. Might not be all of it in commercialization, but there is no, you know, quick wins. I invented something last year and I'm going to slay agriculture. You're like, I just haven't seen it happen. I've seen other things. And once you peel back the onion, you're like, oh yeah, there's years of individual science contributed, time of an actual company. And even the fast ones are 5 years, six, yeah, eight, but there's background of stuff that preceded it. So you're like, right, it's not a place for quick wins. But the other part that the money, you know, it's never good that it tightens up, but as it tightens up, it rationalizes it and demands that it's might not be the, you know, new dating app type response, right? Whatever the global favor is.
However, swipe right for yield.
That 5 year, 10 year push to become something incumbent in global agriculture has a way longer profitable tail. It creates a lot more residual value, no different than farmer improving, you know, I bought a piece of land and I made it better. And yeah, I'm getting the market rate, but if I make it real much more valuable through my productivity, that's a lasting, appreciating, and accelerating asset.
And well, you look at a
time.
Yeah. And so that was just my thought is, so when most farmers I know and see around, honestly, are doing pretty good. Some I know are insanely wealthy from land assets to beyond. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the biggest pieces of it all. And then, you know, if that land's owned and you can own some equipment and it's incremental, it builds up. And, you know, so some people will joke, you know, especially maybe more urban people to rural people, is like, oh, there's no such thing as a poor farmer. And I mean, that's clearly not true. There is less of it than it used to be. Because that was kind of the statement. And I, you know, as we were talking before, like, I mean, my dad farmed in the 80s, that kind of took him out. Yeah, that was a tough time. People, you know, some people got through, some didn't. And then you look at other boom bust cycles, you know, the 50s were good, 40s were weird, you know, because of the war. And then you have the dirty 30s. And you look at all these generational things. And while, yes, some farmers are doing really well right now, that's taken 100 to 150 years of just grinding through the shittiness of ag, in a sense, and changing the stories. Like the 80s helped change what has become the new farm policy.
Yeah.
To get it to a point where people don't have to worry as much about living or dying on their farm almost.
Yeah. And I think there's still that scale of, you know, smaller U.S. farmers that are challenged, but we came out of a good period. So it's always a lagging indicator. So doing well has to do that land values haven't adjusted, right? They're still creeping up. Commodity prices are down. Interest rates are up, but they made hay while the sun shines, right? So there's the period of stability. I don't know any of them that are doing well that lack disillusionment, like something bad's not going to happen. Right?
The only few that
they're like, hey, we're buckled in. Like it's good, but don't get carried away because I can't buy more land. That like there's moves that they've made to be sustainable or at least weather some of the storms, but not impervious. But that's why they're good.
Well, the few that do get in trouble are usually the younger guys that kind of
aggressive, overextend
aggressive. Maybe, I mean, I was the conference that I was at this week. A guy was telling me a story. He's like, honestly, the kid got in because I think something happened to his grandpa basically is like, here's the farm because his dad wasn't doing it. It's like, here. And the bank was like, oh, you got sign off from grandpa? Yeah, here's all this money. You should buy this new equipment. The bank was telling him what to buy. Yeah. He's like, yeah, sure, if you'll let me. And it's almost bankrupted the entire farm. He said to sell 3/4 of all the equipment he had. And I think there was some other restructuring. Wow. It was like,
I mean, wonder like the equipment dealer and bank were in cahoots or something. You're like, yeah, I get it. But you know, that protection of value is so important. And farms are as entities. I mean, this is the other part that it's funny, not funny, depending on who you are. But I'm like, these startups, oh, we raised $5 million, $10 million, and we're going to control the U.S. market. And you're like, that 3,000-acre farm's worth more than your company has raised. Its valuation is far more than yours. So don't get too delusional. And that's one farm. And you need to influence ones that are worth not only $10 million, $50 million, $100 million companies, which we call farms, that you're important is, you know, it's like, I find it funny and ironic. It's like, well, these farmers, we're going to help them. I'm like, hopefully you get to spend some time with any of them. And you realize that some of them are exceptional. A lot of them are exceptional CEOs and business people just because of the dimensions of running a large farm operation from a financial standpoint it just blows my doors off.
Well, some of them, I mean, there's a few that I've known that you know, like I said, their wealth is built up. And then because they've had to deal with so much extra financialness of everything and bigger equipment and different harder conversations with accountants and their banker and people like that. Then it's like they jump into these other sectors of industry that you just wouldn't get in normally unless you had just a passion or a want for it, like investment strategies. And they become like their own investment bankers.
Yeah, their own family office.
Yeah, and have all these other intricate pieces. I mean, you learn grain marketing because you have to. The only reason, and so you start getting all these little intricate pieces. But to your point, it's a great point. It's like, oh, great, you raised $10 million. I mean, that's cool. I spend $10 million every year, and I'm me and my son or something like that.
My input bill is $10 million.
Yeah, it's my tax bill. Like, I mean, I know some that it's like my property tax bill is $10 million.
Exactly. So, I mean, that's a really cool part that I think is, you know, once again, just one of those gaps that money and that piled in. And it's not that it's, well, maybe I'm going to say they don't feel good about it necessarily that they figured out the return, but not going into it with it, maybe find a friend, a Sherpa guide, someone that can speak honestly, because I think it's one of the best places to invest is agriculture because of the dynamics, but you better do it really wisely. And it can be from the VC to the PE side, but like farmer, you know, the farmer two scenarios, the ones that have their own family office and are doing, extending their financial prowess and strength, right? Building the balance sheet and power, you know, to the aggressive, hey, I have a bunch of leverage to apply. You're like, that it's good, but you know, talk to someone really smart about how leverage has been applied. Not the 16 who gets the $2 million inheritance. Like,
yeah, well, there is a lot of that in ag too. So it gets wild, but
yeah,
you know, it kind of makes me think of a point in, you know, from the corporate side, and you've worked in it and I have too. And sometimes I've seen this a lot lately. Maybe it's changing. And maybe it's more of a closing thought. I know we're getting close. But like on the large company corporate end is, you know, the ones that work with farms, they need to think more like some of these large business farms, because sometimes they cycle through different leadership, like every 2 years. And then that person makes a change, but it totally changes the entire landscape of what they're doing on, say, the technology and in ag. I've experienced this many times just from our family business. I know many others that have experienced similar things. And it's like they're letting somebody that doesn't understand it make these insane, huge decisions that affect the industry. My example, because I'll just say it, I don't care. We were working with Pioneer and doing a lot of their imagery. New guy came in. Drones became a big thing. 2015, they're like, we're going to do drones nationwide, Pioneer seat.
Yeah.
We're going to do that instead. I was like, you can't do that. That's impossible.
Yeah.
That was just, it was the rule. And then things ended. It's like, but you can't do that. I was like, I'm not against drones. Like, they fit. It's just like,
no, there's no.
And it's like, why does that always still happen? And I mean, you're working with different large groups that are, you're trying to almost prove them not to do some of those things by doing these trial results.
Right. And
working with that data. Do you see a shift in that happening?
No, I bet that's still getting to so much then.
Sorry, all corporate people that are on this thing.
Maybe I could say, yeah, no, it's changing. It's changing. It's changing because, you know, they're all facing this relationship between rate of innovation to value capture. And the things that are innovating are still very valuable, and I'm not dissing that. But the rate of gain to the market sizing issue, they're going to have to get more specific and efficient at delivering something that this farm or that field really wants out of the pipeline. And you go, or is that fixed? Oh, you go, it's just the bioinformatics, the trialing, the data collection, the commercial deployment. Aside from that, it's straightforward, right? You're like, wow, but they got to get really good at it, and they're tightening their belts. But I think that's the nature of, you know, one of the things that is always a caution to them is like, you throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You're like, whoa, like, change is good. Sometimes shaking things up gets rid of the fat and the fluff, right? You're like, this can't carry on. However, sometimes you get these carte blanche, you know, personalities, and they make a sweeping change that pretty much, unbeknownst to the company, neuters itself like 3 years out. Like, where'd that happen?
And it's and then sometimes there's employees internally that will even, you know, warn.
Oh, they'll be fired.
But then you get that fear. It's like, how it's supposed to work that way, but it doesn't work.
No.
It's why I'm doing what I'm doing, I suppose. It's probably the simplest
answer. Likewise, I mean, it's part of our, you know, the council that you know, you can build long-term data strategies and software, and you can make changes and improvements, but don't skip the obvious part of, like, talk to the experts, and not just your internal experts, maybe get another point of view. And always works, survey your farmer customer, because at the end of the day, you know, if it's a big decision, don't skip that farmer engagement and put it against the backdrop of the relevance of the technology, where you're at, what you're invested in. Like, some things need to be killed in R&D world or things you're doing. But if you're reckless about it, you can inflict serious wounds that are often underestimated. And I think that's, I would like to say it's not going to happen. Just as I would like to say, it's not going to be a new startup with some individual that, you know, is going to disrupt us all, and they get $100 million and actually believe that it's happening. To conversely, the new person that comes from industry XYZ and says, "Hey, I've got a new senior position. I'll fix ag." You're like, start with the premise is ag ain't broken. It's not broken. It's exceptionally productive and efficient. You'll never find a group of people around the planet that work harder or more willing to change. So that disgusts me. Since we're talking uncentered, I'm like, if I hear that one more time, I'm going to snap. They are collectively exceptional at what they do.
Well, it's come to the point we grow too much food actually right now.
Yeah. It's a distribution issue, not a quantity issue. It's like, we can crank up the 10 billion people. I'm like, we could probably feed them right now. It's just, it's not necessarily calories in the hands or currencies or other dysfunctions security wise that it doesn't happen.
Well, you don't have because I love analogies and clearly I turn them into memes a lot of times, but when a new variety hybrid comes out or a new chemical, typically the farm doesn't just say, we're putting all this one variety in and this one chemical and this, and we're just, it's all that. It's like, I'm not saying it's never happened. I'm sure it has happened, but
right.
Yeah. But, and sometimes that's, what I've seen in, from the corporate ag end, but even from smaller companies, it's like, yeah, you need to find sometimes that niche, that thing. It's like, and push hard. But, I think people are starting to learn you just got to really think about the ag industry and how it is and have a plan of building up some of these other tools that do other things for others. Because if you have just one thing, you got to start somewhere for sure.
Yep.
Just like, how you guys started. But I think you had a plan. It's like, well, these things will come up. And some have came into it not even thinking of what can happen or what should be the next step. And here we are.
Yeah. No, I'm 100% on that one. Is that, you want to be aggressive, but most of the stuff is step change to an already pretty good system. The home runs of, like I said, high speed planting or GPS. That one took a long time. A Roundup Ready, like those are pretty exceptional events within ag. So I almost start with the mindset that it's a pretty awesome system as it is, and what you're bringing. How do you meet the demand if you're the innovative side of making it better, and not in press releases, not in theory. Get in the mix, and if a farmer can't get them to say yes to that, you're actually making it better, then you're just delusional and someone's going to lose money. And if the farmer loses money, you lose the customer. And if you lose money, you're out of business.
Yeah. So. Well, but before that, you could have just started another startup and got another $10 million and tried it again.
Well, those days appear to be missing for
yes, listeners. I concur. I know a few that are attempting it, and I guess we'll see what happens. I don't know. We'll see. But
no, something will happen. We know that, but I think it's it. And the good news, well, the positive side of me is like it's doable. But I appreciate the time and the, like you said, the good stories and memes and appropriate skepticism, because as much progress as we've made in the last decade, I think, like always, and this is my fear and sort of the AI part, is let's not ding ourselves up too much in the process with the collective farm relationships that they're adopting like crazy. It's just not adopting fast enough for everyone's bad ideas. So they're fine. We just need to keep the innovation and delivery engine working.
Well, and with all the, we've seen this growth up of software and hardware and sensors, and now it's like we're in this, from AI to biologicals. Like, I guess from all the testing and stuff you're seeing, different result trials, because clearly you're doing a lot of stuff with all these biological groups. Yeah. And some of them raised a lot and are doing, they need to spend a lot to make these things work.
Right.
Prove that they work. That's just how that kind of industry part of ag works. There's probably a generally concern that some are going to promise a lot and underdeliver, and then, whatever. They almost don't want the testing and the tools that you do, because it just proves that it's not going to work.
Right.
Are you seeing, though, because I think they all have the same problem, and I've talked about it before, is yes, some of these biologicals work in certain situations, certain parts of the field, certain soil types, certain crop types. But then, some are saying, oh, just put it everywhere. Are they changing that tune? to say ours are built more for these specific things, and that's all we're going to do. So then they kind of stay in their lane.
Yeah, they is a big group, right? Yeah. It's like biologicals includes a lot of things that aren't even biological by definition. So I think there's a lot of companies and candidates, right? And let's just look at them as biological based tools. Leave it at that and not try to segment them. But I think they have to rationalize and think through what is my positioning, right? And there's some that are what I'd say not at the scientific level they need to be before they even get to an on-farm trial. I don't believe in that type of, hey, let's get it on a farm. It showed some efficacy on a lettuce in my back porch. And you're like, I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
You need your early science and that piece to work. And then as you go to on-farm trials, you really do need to characterize. Before you're going to that wormhole, what are you doing from regulatory? Do you understand your site or mode of action or multiple sites and plant response or physiology or soil response? The days of it does something in the soil that's good, or, you know, if there's some good companies in that space that are getting much better at the science that's going to translate to good on-farm trials and deployment. But there's also a lot of stuff that, you know, is supported or funded by people that I'm pretty sure out of the plethora has no merit of spending another dollar, right? So I think that was my corporate experience when we work with that. You get pretty ruthless of, you know, what you're not going to do in your tech tower, and innovation is just as important as what you do. And when it's completely fragmented across millions of companies and candidates, you know, something's not right. So I think as an industry and farmers, we got to continue to hold the beat to the fire of the innovators. Otherwise like I said, I'm the half kind of guy, but I think there's a lot of stuff that's going to slip through our cracks and or maybe already has that I'm concerned is not helping our collective farmer acceptance, right? And it's like, they're not adopting. That's because we like the AI, which I like AI as solutions. Mm-hmm. You start pushing out bad stuff. Then we go, why aren't they adopting? Well, we delivered a bunch of crap for 5 years and then told them to buy more now that we have it figured out. No. Or 10. So,
well, are we going to... My fear, and I think a lot of people have this too, and we were talking about it early, and I'll kind of close with this question, and then because it's a broad one, and you have experience on this because you worked at Monsanto.
I did.
And you see, you know, the push of Roundup Ready, and it's like Roundup, it'll kill everything. It's the only thing, but you know, clearly have different issues with it becoming, you know, other weeds have started tolerating it, and like, you don't work anymore. Is the biological side, are we going to have that? Is that a reality? Because I fear that some soils, because it's something from another area, it's not quite matched up, will be like, no. So now we're going to go wreck other microbes that we're going to compete against. And we just create this whole weird soil problem or plant problem or whatever that biological is being used for. Maybe it's a makes the grain not even edible or something because it was put on.
Absolutely.
Changes the DNA structure. I don't know.
Well, that's not a great, crazy premise. So I think you're on the where I was and you know, it's a hyper complex problem and
yes.
You know, good science in the beginning starts. But to your point, like glyphosate Roundup, it worked and you know, the premise was yeah, it sure does. It still works on many weeds. But if you have one weed and that species takes over the whole, a farmer looks at it as, I don't care if I have one species or 900. If it's a weedy field, it's a weedy field because it's impacting productivity. So that is a practical example that you go, okay, what will we learn? And this ties into resistance management, whether it's in the herbicide or insect control and unintended consequences. So what you're theorizing is something that we have to understand and accept. Is I think that the difficult thing is we need to pursue it because there's going to be benefits. I think as we use AI, bioinformatics, like what do we learn about, particularly for something that goes in the soil into an already dynamic population, right? So as you look at it, like a country, right, with people, and you throw some more stuff in, something will happen.
And there's only a few wars on this planet.
Right, right. So you go, I don't know if what specifically happens. I think we characterize the biologicals that we're putting into the environment. We should be very thoughtful if they're native or, but, you know, it's akin to, you know, what's environmental fate or how does this impact the environment or my system? You know, I think there's some good process regulatory wise starting to raise the bar of environmental fate and interaction, but it's also a hyper complex, you know, interaction that you're going, we can not reliably predict corn yield at a field level with perfect resolution, right? We can get pretty close. And the closer we get to harvest, the better we are with an array of tools. But you say, what's this, what's going to happen with the system changes of biorationals? I think we have to use what we've learned to be open-minded to go, could something happen in terms of resistance or adaptation to a biological system? You say, for sure it will, not it could. And predicting what the maybe adverse or unanticipated outcome might be, that's a fruitless game of speculation. But it does drive you to say, well, as we do pursue these, we can't just not monitor and learn more about their impact. So it's just a wild thing.
We don't need a COVID of soil.
No.
Going around. And yes, I won't get into the whole politics of that, but you know, a lot of farmers, you know, regulation is a challenge in the world.
Anything.
More, you know, the ethical side of how farmers think regulation is tough because there's been, you know, good and bad clearly to it. But I think they really have to be smart and think about this and use their brain power, be like, okay, I am okay with some regulation when it comes to some of these biologicals. And there are things in place, don't get me wrong. But like, because it's just a different beast. AI is similar in some of the things that it's deciding. It's like, okay, this is cool, but there's this danger point.
Yeah.
And as tech advances in ag, I think we just need to keep those things in mind so we can still stay on this path of great efficiency and growth. And I guess, you know,
feed the world, right? I think this is where we got to self-govern and farmers are the gatekeeper, because if we try to regulate unanswerable questions, what that'll guarantee is innovation stops.
That's the other side of it. That's right. Why.
I'm on that side of the fence of like, okay, we let's not seek help where it can't be provided, right? Which usually is government. It's like, yeah, they're going to come help us. And you're like, probably not.
However, set some base rules, but like you said, self-govern let's be logical and common sense in our own approaches.
And I think that's from farmers, crop associations, state associations, they can be very forthright of setting maybe not regulatory frameworks, but performance. You know, how are they going to adopt these more biological sustainable type tools? And I think that'd be a great place to start, if like back to, you know, it's self-gratifying. It's like, well, how are you testing and modeling that, right? How do we know it works and placing them correctly? I'm not saying you set some frameworks that collectively the farmers are going, all right, if I don't know if they can build like certified product lists or things like that where you go, you know what? If it hasn't had some merit, hasn't ever been tested on a farm, XYZ, that it may be regulatory approved, but the farmers and the associations are going, it hasn't been through some acceptable,
validation stuff. And it's like, it's like the farmers and other like organizations, maybe, and you know, groups like yourself, people like me, create some guidelines to say like, hey, depending on where you're at in the world, because like we've talked, ag is different everywhere.
Yeah.
And we need to do that self-governing more, but it does need to happen.
Launching bad products just absolutely, you know, it kills us. And it's, you know, you go, where's the money going? You're going, launching bad products and not applying some practicality or concentrated investment and just hoping the farmers freak out when it performs badly. Like that is not that doesn't seem like the logical way to go about innovating productively, right? Even innovation can become more efficient between the farm and the companies. And yeah, biologicals so far I've seen real progress, real opportunities, but I also see a mound of things that I think could derail the good stuff. And that's the worst outcome.
Yeah. Well, and like I said, to that point, we need to build things that are good and actually work and don't tear us down. And hey, not everything, like I said, but there's definitely been some ag tech plays that have kind of thrown us backwards a little bit to where we should have been or could have been or should
be. That's where I'll leave it up to you for the memes.
I'm getting into more the GIFs and videos and I got a lot of stuff coming, but those things take more time and
now they're running in the back of my head. I just as a business serving B2B, I probably can't share them all. So
hey, that's why I'm here as that independent voice. That's why I'm here and doing this.
Sometimes I'm thinking it. So
well, that's usually what people reply to me from either things on the podcast now here, but especially as my was writing and memes are like, thanks for saying that. I definitely can't say that. I would get fired right away, but you're 100% right. And that exactly happened. Don't stop, please, for the love of God.
Well, there you go. Exactly.
So everyone be honest out there or just tell me the truth and I'll.
Yeah, we got it. That's where individuals like yourself and farmer groups and things like that can need to keep speaking truths as seen from that side. So,
Well, I'll do my part. You're doing your part to showcase that some of these things work or they don't work and the value. So I think what you've built in your team, Randy, is awesome and keep keeping on. Cause I mean, we need like 100 groups like you in theory. I know for business wise, you don't probably want that,
but I'm with you. The directionally, I'll take it that there's room for 100 more. We're not inviting them in any more than a farmer invites a neighbor, but I think we believe that much that getting it done right outweighs any competition.
There's a lot of room.
Yeah, there's tons of room.
that's the thing people need to remember in ag is like on the tech side, like adoption is still pretty low. There's a lot of room for people to get involved in this still to work and for money to come in and work properly. We learned some things that don't, and we've learned some things that did, and we just got to kind of, to the whole points we've been talking through is we have to use time and learn from our mistakes and learn from our clients and get to the next point in a sound and logical way that doesn't destroy us in the process.
Wipe us out in the process.
But so anyways, thanks Randy for being on this episode and no, it was great having you on. I think we got through a lot of pieces and heavy subjects and some fun parts, and I think people enjoy it. So thanks again for being on.
Awesome. Appreciate the time and the opportunity and the fun Alberta stories you shared in the beginning.
Yeah. Tell your friends of that you now can bungee jump at any time. If they still have it, maybe they got sued for something that's not there anymore. I have no idea.
That product launch.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. So anyways, to all my listeners out there, thanks for listening, and tell your friends to share and subscribe and all that fun stuff. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.